Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons.
Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Doug Corwin, who's the owner of Crescent Duck Farm up in Aquabog, I believe it is. And he's, as you can see him there, he's in from the field. I was just asking him what time he gets up in the morning, because the ducks don't get up when the alarm rings. So start with that.
Well, I try to be here at 6 every morning. This is a 7-day-a-week type thing where you have to get used to farming every day. So I would have been here a little bit earlier if we were in our normal routine. I would have been here 4:30, 5 o'clock, but 6 o'clock seems to work right now given the turmoil that we went through this winter.
How large is the Crescent Duck Farm?
We have about 140 acres right now here in Aquabog that we, 13 generations ago, a Corwin came over to Southold and with the original families and bought this land. And we started growing ducks in 1908 and have about 20 or so barns on this property. Plus, we have a feed milling business in Eastport.
When I got out here, which was 1956, I was a teenager and come out with my dad. And we were moving here at the time. He bought a drugstore out in Montauk. And I came from New Jersey, so I didn't know much about anything about this. But we'd stop every once in a while, and he'd pull over in front of Turkey Wire Fence, what then was Route 27, going through all the towns. And we'd feed the ducks breadcrumbs. They'd come quacking over. They were very excited to see us, and some others smelled bad. But that was part of being a duck.
Well, there wasn't much out here. And I was born in 58, so I can't remember back that far. But between potatoes and vegetables and the fishing industry and a huge number of duck farms, it's about all that was out here at that point in time.
You know, I spoke to Bill Hendrickson, who was the weatherman out here. I'm sure you know the name.
Yes.
He was already about 100 years old at the time I spoke to him. And I asked him about the Depression, because he was a young man at that point back in the crash of 29. And he told me that twice a week, he and his dad and mom would load up the wagon in a car, and they would bring it around to all the people that needed food and various other things to eat, because there were no jobs to be had.
Nice.
And that was how that worked. And just thinking about global warming, it's the most sensible thing to think about is having your food be right where you are and fresh. Tell me about the farm, the whole farm.
We're a little bit of an anomaly. When I got out of Cornell, in 1980, there were 30 duck farms still on the island. And between real estate prices and labor and a lot of inherent difficulties that most of the others had, they all went out of business and we're the last one left. But we've learned how to meet the requirements, the environmental requirements of the DEC. We do a phenomenal job. I've got a huge waste treatment plant that takes duck shit and makes it drinking water quality as far as nitrogen goes, which is phenomenal. We breed at ducks, we hatch ducks, we grow ducks, we process ducks. At least before I had this outbreak in January, we were doing roughly 3.5% of the country here and supplying most of the upper end restaurants in the Northeast, but then spot marketing around the country and other parts of the world.
How many ducks were there on the farm?
Normally, we would produce just under 1 million a year, but that meant we had roughly 100,000 birds at any given time on the farm.
What happened in January?
In January, somehow that avian flu virus got into my flocks, and that avian flu virus is very devastating to ducks, and federal policy is that once it's on a farm, that entire farm has to be euthanized. Yeah. So we lost everything except for some older hatching eggs in January. So we had a very, very ugly situation here at that point.
How did it resolve?
How does it resolve?
How did it resolve?
Well, every living thing was euthanized on the farm. The USDA brought in contractors and a bunch of their own people and worked with my farm staff. And just a very ugly, very, very sad time where all the ducks had to become compost and every barn had to be sanitized. And we were lucky we were able to save some of our genetics and take them off the property after there was properly genetics through eggs, save some eggs and take them off the property. And so at least we kept what keeps us in business going. But at the same time, this farm had to be sterilized. So we went through a 4-month period where every single ounce of manure had to be removed and cleaned. And in April, the end of April, we went through with aphis and we did 25 swabs and 20 barns to make sure there was absolutely no viral particles left and everything came clean. So we've started to repopulate the farm with the small amount of genetics that we were able to save that we put on other farms elsewhere.
Have you restored it to a good percentage of it anyway?
No. You have to realize it takes 4 weeks to incubate a bird, an egg. It takes 26 weeks before a bird is sexually mature. I only have a fraction of 6% of the breeding stock that I would normally have. So I've got to reproduce those to get another generation. So I'm really not going to be in business until June of next year when I have a second generation up and laying eggs.
Tell me about a typical day of the duck farm before genetics was, as you...
Well, I normally would have 70 or so employees, 70 to 75 employees. I've got a farming business, I've got a USDA processing business, and I've got a feed milling business. Plus, I oversee a Cornell research lab in Spionk that makes vaccines for duck diseases that are sold all across the world. So my day spins like a top, spending my day coordinating with managers, setting out plans, wondering what marketplace we're going to take care of this given day, be it a fresh marketplace in New York or Boston or Washington, or what we're producing, how things are hatching, how things are living, how things are growing. My day spins like a top, just coordinating with people. And as you can see, I'm going to work dressed as a farmer. So I might be in the office half the day, or I might be in some shitty place getting myself knee deep in something at one part of the day if there was a problem. I never know what a given day, which is good. When I got to Cornell, I could have gone anywhere. I had phenomenal grades at Cornell. I could be a doctor, a lawyer, whatever, but this is fun. I get to play. I get to be in the office. I'm not beholden to some corporate boss. It's an interesting existence, but it's a challenging one. Very challenging.
Well, are there any other siblings in your family?
I've got a brother. I've got a sister. I've got two sons that are in the business. They're in their 40s, maybe three or four other family members. But I also have a core of really good long-term employees. When this happened to us in January, I had 72 people, and I'd only hired 4 new people out of 72 during the 2024. And my average person's been here about 15 years. So I've got a lot of very well-trained people. I've kept on about 16 of them. We're rebuilding barns. We're trying to rebuild our flocks. It's a very slow process, but it's a very interesting business.
Do you sell ducks on the, to the retail to people who stop by like I used to do?
Like you used to do. Yeah. USDA frowned on that. You realize we're geared towards wholesale. I sell to large distributors. I mean, I have most of the upper end restaurant trade in the Northeast. So I'm selling the Chef Warehouses, the Baldors, the Lafritas, the D'Artagnans, the big distributors who will in turn come back and sell to the Stone Creeks or the Faunas or the other restaurants around. So my business is geared towards taking care of these people that are using fresh product, pallets of fresh product weekly to stop the sell to a duck. I try to pawn people off to good people like Cromer's Market or Mulaski's Turkey Farm or Bayview Farm Stand or a lot of the nice finer markets that are selling duck instead of trying to do much in the way of retail here.
When you were growing up, did you ever think you might want to be something besides doing what the family had done all these years?
Well, I always told my father I was going to do something else. I think we all kind of rebel against our parents a little bit at a point in time. But when I saw that I could be my own boss, when I saw that I could have an awful lot of flexibility in what my day was like, and I'm in a small industry. I've been president of the National Duck Council multiple times. I run a Cornell research lab. I do a lot of very interesting things. And I saw that when I was coming out of Cornell, and I said, wow, this could be kind of fun. And yeah, I like to think that I'm kind of the reason why there still is a duck industry here on Long Island. I kind of enjoy it. What we've done over the last 50 years is phenomenal. Being changing our genetics and taking care of environmental problems. Yeah, I still grow ducks. It's not a rose farm here. It's never going to be a rose farm. But I think we've done an awful lot compared to what it used to smell like when you were feeding those ducks outside that turkey wire when you were driving out from New Jersey way back when. Things have changed, and things are always going to change. And I don't know. I want to die a duck farmer. But my boys do down the road. They both work for us here. One runs the feed mill. One takes care of portions of the farm. That's on them. But I'm 66, and I got a long ways to go.
Yeah, very young to me. But the Corwin family is also, they're all over. I'm in New York right now, but the Corwin family was, I think it's known as sort of a Bridgehampton family.
Well, Matthias Corwin came over from Connecticut with Reverend John Young back in the 1640-something and settled South Old Town. I'm the 13th generation from Matthias Corwin. He actually bought the land that I'm on right now. And yeah, he had three sons, I believe. So yeah, that Corwin spread out far and wide. We just happen to be the stubborn ones that are still here on the North Fork growing ducks. But there's a lot of Corwins around. And people ask me all the time, am I related to so-and-so? And I'm sure I am at some point in time. But my great-grandmother was a Halleck that was born in Hallackville. And I've got remnants of the old furniture from that place because my ties go very, very strong here on the North Fork.
Did you know your grandfather really well when you were growing up?
My grandfather passed away in a hospital room that I was in at the time when I was 17, and he was a role model. He was a builder. He was a positive person. He said we were to get from point A to point B. Between my father, my grandfather, and a salesman that we had at the time, my life was shaped. I learned direction. I learned how to do things. I learned how to get people to come on board and see a vision. But yeah, my grandfather was a very positive thing, even in the short 17 years that I knew him.
Talk a little bit about the history of the Polish invasion, because down in the Hamptons anyway, and I don't know, tell me about the North Fork, but in the Hamptons, I'd say at that time, and there were farms everywhere, as you know, they found what they wanted to do in the Hamptons with potatoes.
Well, I'm only 66. I went to school with a lot of kids of Polish descent who were from potato farming families. And if you're a historian, you realize that Poland has been beaten up between Russia and Germany so many times back and forth and back and forth that it forced an awful lot of hardship, and a lot of Polish people immigrated quickly to this country. A lot of them settled on the North Fork, and I assume a lot of them started working on farms. And eventually, as they saved their money and their pennies, they wound up moving to buying these farms. And through hard work, they were very successful. I have to hand them to them. There was a separate wave of Polish migration in the 80s when the communists were taken out. But going back to the early days, yeah, I can remember the Sidlowskis, the Romanowskis, and you can come up with an awful lot of names on your side, the Grigellas. They were all Polish that became really good farmers.
I remember that immigration because there was a travel agency in Riverhead that was very active in getting people out of Poland.
Sure.
And I met the guy who ran it, and it's kind of fallen away along with duck farming. And another duck farmer who became quite successful, he became the president of the North Fork Bank when he was...
Oh, you're talking about John Canis.
Yes, John, that Adam, right.
Yes.
Retirement opened a duck farm in Mauritius. I don't know if it's still there, but it was like a reminder of what he had been doing. It was very well.
He's got quite the estate there over in East Mauritius, taking those old duck barns and making them look like mini mansions. It's very interesting driving by his property. His cousin used to work for us for a period of time, and they all came from that Canis farm in East Mauritius, and he did very, very well at North Fork Bank and his buyout and his later career banking still. And he still resides out here, right? I haven't run into it. Well, in Florida, between Florida and here.
Yeah.
I haven't run into him in many years, but no, he's an interesting character.
He sure was. Thank you for being on the podcast. We've run into our end of time for another minute or two. And what would you like to talk about? You have sons and daughters?
I have sons. I have two boys with me. I have a daughter who teaches high school in Manhattan. You and I both are, you know, we're not young kids anymore. And we've seen the transformation of the Hamptons and the transformation of the North Fork. I remember H. Lee Dennison saying he wanted a Douglas County back in the 60s when we had a huge environmental problem. And now it almost seems that the community's rallying behind any of us farmers trying to hold on to us and keep us in business. And it really is a good feeling seeing the support that the community has given us. Dan, I could be richer if I bulldozed my barns and sold the property here. I don't want that. I want to die a duck farmer. It's in my blood. It's what I do. I believe it's what my boys do. And seeing the community behind us really means an awful lot.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the podcast. I've enjoyed it, and I hope you have. And we'll talk soon again.
It was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Take care.